Coming up today, chimps make another stride towards personhood, a vast supervoid may be the biggest thing ever, literally, and how the internet may have just changed the general election, for real this time. All that and more, coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from supercilious supervoids to campaigning chimps. I'm your host, Michael Rundle, and I'm editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Katie Collins.
And I'm James Stamperton.
Now, the good news this week is that Liat is back at Wired.
We've seen her in everything.
But she's just not in the room today, because unfortunately she's not feeling so well.
Yeah, get better soon, Liat.
But we've had a lot of messages on Twitter and email asking where Leah is, so don't worry, she is back, and she'll be here next week, hopefully.
Hooray!
Hooray.
Speaking of not feeling very well, you're probably not going to be feeling very well on Sunday.
You refer, of course, to the titanic challenge of me versus nature.
Yes, over
the London Marathon. Yeah, it's my first London Marathon. I'm quite nervous at this point. I really don't know what to expect. And also, I've just heard there's going to be a thunderstorm this Sunday.
Excellent.
Which I think makes it more dramatic and maybe more helpful.
Yes.
Mm.
It will cool
you down.
True, unless I get struck by lightning, in which case I'll be very warm. Yes.
So. I feel like it's almost like it will make it into a kind of movie or, you know, like a montage of sort of weather and, you know, and I think in English literature we used to call that pathetic fallacy.
That's the one. But only if your marathon is particularly dramatic. It might just be very long and arduous.
Well, obviously I have a team of videographers running alongside me recording everything.
But so. are you actually using any technology to help you on your quest?
Well, I do have, you know, a range of wearables I've been trying over the last sort of 6 months during my training. None of them, to be honest, have really done it for me. So I think at this point I'm really just sticking to glucose and some sort of hypothetically good trainers to pull me through. But I think really the important thing is pseudoscience in running is rampant, and almost everything you think can help you really can't. Mm. So I'm just sticking to the road.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, good luck. Also, do you listen to music while you run? This is one thing that always interests me.
I do, and I think by this point, we've known each other for a month now, you know who I listen to when I run. It's Andrew WK, cult rock star and motivational speaker.
Yes.
And really, 4 hours of Andrew WK gives you a certain kind of focus that will help you over the line, I think.
Excellent.
So for any other runners out there, I really recommend you switch entirely to listen to his music.
I might give that a go.
Absolutely. Right, that's all for now. Let's get on with the news. So, Katie, this week there was some intriguing developments in the potential addition of a new species to the family of people.
Yes, that's right. So something quite unprecedented happened in the United States. A pair of chimpanzees that were being held at a university research facility have been granted a key legal right regarding unfair detention. Now, this is something that's only ever previously been extended to human beings. In a historic ruling by the New York Supreme Court, it was determined that two apes named Hercules and Leo, excellent names, who are currently kept at Stony Brook University for the purposes of biomedical research, are actually covered by a writ of habeas corpus, the law that governs against unfair detention.
Now, this is part of an ongoing fight to release the apes from the medical facility. That's right, isn't it?
That's right. So this comes after 2 years of the animal rights organisation, the Non-Humans Rights Project, and they launched a legal case to try and free four chimpanzees that were unlawfully imprisoned. And basically, they've managed to kind of get this far, and they've got this ruling in New York State. It's not necessarily going to work out that well for the chimps. We don't know yet.
Well, so this is one of
they're not people yet.
No,
it was widely reported that they had been declared persons, but that's actually not quite right, is it?
No. So basically what's happened is they've had the habeas corpus issued on their behalf, which has previously only been extended to legal persons. Now, this doesn't mean that the chimpanzees are legal persons, but what it's doing is it's looking at kind of cognitively complex animals and saying, you know, do they deserve the same right as people? And until now, that's that's been kind of totally off the cards, and there'll be further hearings that are going to be required before they're actually afforded legal personhood.
Doesn't this all come down to the fact that chimps aren't as clever as us? This is what's going to be argued.
Well, it really depends what kind of defence the university put up. So they have been ordered to appear in court in May to reply to the claims that Hercules and Leo are being held unlawfully. And if they find that the case, if the court finds the case insufficient, then the chimps could look forward to a new life of freedom, which I believe will be in the care of Save the Chimps, a Florida sanctuary.
So this would effectively make the detention of chimps anywhere in New York State illegal. It could, if they win.
Well, it could, and this is the thing with these landmark cases, that they set a precedent then for others kind of pursuing these cases. And I'm sure the NHRP, the organisation that's pursued this case, will definitely be going, you know, after others, and they won't just be looking at chimps either. So they could potentially, you know, pursue similar cases in future for other really cognitively complex animals like elephants, great apes, whales, dolphins. And, you know, a lot of people are already, you know, making the case against holding dolphins in kind of aquariums and dolphinariums around the world, you know, saying that it's really harmful to them to be held this way.
As anyone that's seen blackfish will understand. Yes, yeah. These creatures are incredibly clever. What do you think, Michael? Are chimps clever enough to be? It's quite an unusual argument, isn't it?
Well, not to throw cold water, I do think the decision this week was more about ensuring that there would be a hearing on both sides. Mm. I think a lot of the legal analysis that sort of came out a few hours after the initial rush of headlines was saying, you know, the judge hasn't really expressed an opinion on whether chimps are persons or not. It's really more about making sure the university comes to the table and it can hear both sides before any kind of decision is made. And I think this was an appeal against a decision that decided in December or some point last year that they weren't persons. So I think the debate is still kind of ongoing. Although I do think it kind of raises an interesting question, which is there is a range of cognitive abilities among humans and there's a range of cognitive abilities among chimps. They're at some point maybe, you know, close to a crossover. I mean, on what basis do we hold people in captivity? I don't know. I mean, I like chimps. Every time I've seen a chimp, I've enjoyed hanging out with the chimp. They're very friendly until they're not. But, has anyone who's seen Planet of the Apes, which I think is a documentary. I'm not quite sure.
No, it definitely is.
I haven't been to San Francisco lately. But, you know, I wish the chimps well. It's an interesting case and it would be fun to see where it develops. I think there was a similar thing in Argentina recently with some orangutans as well. I'm not quite sure on the details of that case, but it's something that's going on in different parts of the world at the moment. So
I think the idea of human rights is quite a recent thing. So to start considering especially intelligent animals in the same sort of bracket is it's very modern thinking that, you know, why shouldn't they be?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I suppose it's about looking at whether they're intelligent enough to understand what's happening to them and whether it's causing them distress. And, you know, being able to judge that and say, well, actually, we've decided that as humans, we're going to give ourselves a certain amount of rights. And, you know, why shouldn't we also think about, you know, animals that can't necessarily sort of make their own rules about that? But we should, you know, we as intelligent beings should have compassion towards other intelligent beings.
And I think that's the point. Empathy and compassion to animals is separate, really, to the legal status of animals as persons or not. And I think almost everyone in the world can look at an animal and feel empathy and see that where they're being badly treated. I don't know the specific conditions of that the two chimps in this case are being held at the university. Maybe that is quite relevant. But, you know, I think we all have empathy for any animal that's involved in this kind of testing, and but it raises an interesting point. I mean, if they were persons, would they then be liable to receive other benefits or join the military? So I don't know. Although there are plenty of animals in the American military anyway, including dolphins.
Yes.
So we wish the chimps well.
Yeah. Good luck, chimps.
James, another non-human but increasingly intelligent presence on our planet is drones, and this week we're seeing some interesting developments there.
Yes, the guy who set up Halo a few years ago now wants to regulate drones. So this is a guy called Jay Bregman. I was speaking to him on the phone the other day. His new company, Verifly, has just raised £1.4 million in funding from tech and aviation investors. And basically, he wants to try and make drones safer and easier to fly without flying them where they shouldn't or into things or crashing them.
And this is in response to a number of high-profile cases of people flying drones irresponsibly in central London or near airports.
Yeah, even this week, a few flights from Manchester Airport were diverted to Liverpool after someone thought they saw a drone over the runway in Manchester. I think it ended up to be a bit of a false sighting, but these are things that are genuinely concerning. These drones are pretty big, and they've been spotted near Heathrow Airport, and if a plane were to fly into them or to panic because it saw one, then this could cause big problems.
So how is Verifly going to tackle this issue?
So the problem is that, as with a lot of technology, drones came along pretty quickly and regulators take a long time to act. In the US, it's going to be a couple of years before the FAA put in place proper regulations around how and where drones can be flown. We're a bit further ahead in the UK, but it's still quite confusing. People don't really understand where it's safe to fly drones, what restrictions there are based on location or time of day even. And so he wants to make this massive database and use geospatial data that drones already collect to inform where they can fly safely.
And it's the idea that the drones would automatically know if they were flying in somewhere that wasn't safe and not be able to fly, or that the authorities would know where drones were flying and be able to check on what's happening in airspace?
I suppose it would be how willing companies would be to open up their data and how willing people would be to open up their data. But a lot of drones are fitted with GPS, so people can see very accurately where they are. You could imagine a future where, just like planes, we all know where planes are based on radar technology, and in the future a GPS light system will be used. So why can't we use that same system or a similar system for drones to really understand all the little things buzzing around the sky and make sure that there's a proper register of who's flying them and where they're flying?
I think that's a really interesting point as well, because the UK have been quite fast at introducing the kind of drone license sort of training testing thing that, you know, you can undertake a qualification, and I don't think it's mandatory for most the majority of drones out there, but if you are flying them for commercial purposes, for example, I think they want you to be able to have a qualification. And I think, unlike things like cars or, you know, other things where you have to have a license, it's going to be really hard to pull that register together, because
the rules are really, really confusing.
Really confusing, because, you know, there are drones of all different sizes. Some are tiny toys, some are much bigger.
Some have cameras, some don't.
Exactly. And also, people can make them themselves. You know, you don't need to, you know, an easy way of going about it would be saying, oh, you know, you have to register when you buy one or something like that. But, you know, people can make these things quite easily and have been doing for years. So keeping that register is going to be really, really tough.
Yeah, so they said that they've been speaking to the drone manufacturers and regulators. The company's going to be based in Ireland. Regulators in Ireland, the UK and the US, including the Met Police and the UK Civil Aviation Authority. So they've got discussions ongoing, but it is an incredibly, incredibly confusing space, so to speak. And they've certainly got their work cut out. But he reckons that they're going to be doing trials using the system in Ireland, the UK and the US later this year. And I was thinking, what's a private company doing, trying to do the job of a regulator, almost?
Well, drone manufacturers have registered interest in being able to build these systems themselves. I think DJI announced a plan to implement something similar, but I think found it was practically not feasible right now. But theoretically, a company might be able to offer services to manufacturers as well as government to be able to build in a system that
I think the idea is this sits on top of the existing regulations and the setups that manufacturers have already got in place or are putting in place, and it will just be some sort of umbrella that will sit over all of it. And I was thinking of it a bit like Halo, and this is where Jay Bragman comes from. Halo and Uber used technology to bring, booking a taxi or getting a taxi wasn't chaotic, but it's been made arguably simpler using technology. And maybe he's coming at this from a similar angle, that drones, pretty chaotic, you can maybe simplify it by using technology.
Yeah, I remember Joe Bregman actually spoke at our Wired 2014 conference last year, just after he'd stepped down from Halo. And I was really interested when he said he was going to get into the business of drones. I couldn't really see where he was going with it, you know, in terms of his experience with Halo. But this, you're right, this kind of makes sense from that point of view.
Yeah, it's a similar sort of system.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that it might be also a tool that drone owners can use rather than just authorities is an important point. Like, as you were saying, Katie, you know, there are training programs out there for drone operators, and often this argument about safety in drones is presented as the authorities versus drone users. But often in my experience, drone operators, and particularly enthusiasts, are very keen on regulation and making sure that this is an area that's people use the equipment responsibly, and that the negative focus is around a few people who kind of aren't aware or less responsible with how they use their drone. And I think the more information people can have and the more tools they can have that can help them, the better, probably. But it's a young industry, and I think it will take some time to develop. And it may be that Verifly ends up doing something slightly different than they're currently presenting. But yeah, we'll wait and see
what
happens.
Time will tell.
James, the general election is rumbling ever closer. And though last week we were talking about the role of the internet generally and social media and the election and how often that hasn't been so transformative, the internet this week has made a big difference.
Yes, I think we can all agree that gov.uk, the government's website that it's been developing over the last few years, is actually pretty good, and they've made a big effort to make lots of data more open. And one thing they have done that is really, really excellent is allowed you to register to vote online. So a very simple online form, chuck in some details and you can get your name added to the electoral roll. And on the last possible day that people could do that before the 2015 general election, nearly 500,000 people did it. And that broke the previous single-day record for voter registrations by 300,000 people.
This is really exciting, isn't it? I mean, one of the great things about the gov.uk website is that you can see these statistics coming in live. You can see how many people are on the website at once, and also go in every 24 hours and see what happened in that previous period. And when we logged on, it was the day before this record was set. It was already enormous. The interest over the weekend was huge.
Yeah.
But then we went and see that the record had been more than tripled, I think.
And it's just insane.
It's just crazy.
Yeah, and it's showing what a really good job open data can do in terms of people understanding what technology is doing for them and also making governments and politics more open and accountable. So in total, 469,047 people use the online system to add their name to the UK's electoral roll, with a further 15,965 registering by post on the last day of registrations. The previous record for a 24-hour period was 166,000. That was set in February 2015.
And we also know how that breaks down in terms of age.
Yeah, and this is the really key thing. So politicians have been babbling on about not enough young people voting for a very long time. Obviously, older people tend to vote in greater numbers, higher percentages, so maybe younger people are underrepresented in politics. So of those registering on the 20th of April, 150,000 of them were aged 25 to 34, and 137,000 of them were aged 16 to 24. So the vast majority of people registering were aged 34 and below.
I'm really excited about how this has the potential to enhance the democracy of the UK. I mean, it seemed like over the past few days, those sort of reminders to register to vote were just everywhere. You know, they were all over social media. They were, I know, as well, Channel 4 is doing a thing where it's shutting down, I think, E4 on the day on polling day in order to encourage people to go out and vote. And I'm really interested to see how this will then translate into voter turnout. And, you know, if this enthusiasm for, you know, making, you know, taking part in the democratic process is anything to go by, you know, we could end up with a really exciting high number for voter turnout.
Well, I think that's one of the things that this brings out, is that young people especially pretty much expect to be able to register for something immediately before they do it.
Yes.
And the fact that they waited right until the last minute, it wasn't just a question of publicity. I think it was a question of, I mean, everyone knows that, you know, we leave things until the last minute in the modern world, and that was another instance. But one of the great things about it that maybe went a little bit underreported was that gov.uk had 100% uptime for the entire period that it experienced this spike.
Which when you've got thousands and thousands of people hammering your web servers at the same time is really impressive. And you can imagine the catastrophe that they would have had if the website had gone down and people weren't able to register to vote. A bit like when you have a really big concert or sporting event like the Olympics, or it's impossible to get tickets.
Or in the US Obamacare, which was something that overshadowed an interesting policy in the first few days that it came online. So there is an IT manager somewhere in the civil service who deserves a huge amount of praise, I think.
Yes.
So well done, IT man.
And so apparently since online voter registration was introduced in June 2014, more than 7.1 million people have used it to join the electoral roll, and that's compared to 2.1 million people doing it by post. So you can see that it's really, really got a lot more people to try and get their name on the electoral roll. And that can only be a good thing.
So all we need now is online voting.
Yes, and then we'll see the voter turnout numbers really shoot through the roof.
Michael, supercilious supervoids.
I love that phrase, and I loved saying it, and I definitely got it the first time. This is an exciting story, a space story. Again, another example of something disturbingly enormous found in space that actually turns out to be more interesting than the fact that it's just really big. So astronomers in Hawaii may have solved a mystery embedded in the background of the universe by identifying the largest single object in existence, which is...
Wow.
It's a big hole, right?
It is a big hole. I mean, that is literally what it is. So the discovery relates to the strange fact that successive temperature maps of the cosmic microwave background have found an unusual huge cold spot in the southern galactic hemisphere. Basically, the spot is way too big and way too cold, and leads to fears that the universe has an unexpected amount of structure and definition, which is problematic for the Big Bang, because although astronomers would expect to see variations in hot and cold through the universe, they wouldn't expect to see something so defined and so big. And so for the last 15 years, essentially, astronomers have been trying to figure out what this thing might be, and also whether it's just a statistical anomaly. Which was ruled out actually in 2013 with the release of the Planck telescope data. So they know that it's there, but they didn't know what it was. In fact, some people even thought it might represent a crossover between two parallel universes.
Oh my goodness.
Crazy people.
Although that is linked to on an official NASA webpage still, so that is an interesting theory. But it does look like it's not true. So one of the other options for explaining this cold spot was essentially that there would be an object in between us and the cosmic microwave background, big enough and cold enough to explain this strange difference in microwaves. And that's pretty much what they think they found. So this would be, if true, a 1.8 billion light year wide region of dark cold space with essentially nothing in it, located just 3 billion light years from Earth, which is actually relatively close. And would be the largest individual structure ever identified by humanity.
I find it really interesting that basically this is like a hole, a big spot, and yet we think of it as an object because of the way that our universe is arranged. I love that idea.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a scale where galaxies would look small in the context of this hole.
Yeah.
So this is a very large thing, it's interesting that we can kind of get an outside perspective on the universe big enough to see it. And that's one of the reasons that this data has taken so long to come about, because in order to study enough space to get a sense of how big this thing is, you need an enormous telescope and new techniques. And those have only just come online, which is why this data has kind of come around now.
So this whole space doesn't have any galaxies in it, or there's a couple kind of floating around?
There would be
somewhere.
Some. Yeah. Again, we're talking on a big scale. So yeah. the distribution of galaxies would be very slim. And the reason that it's cold is due to an effect called the integrated Sachs-Wolf effect. And this is largely because, and this gets complicated, we have more details on the website, but it's really because light which enters the spot leaves with less energy at a longer wavelength than it entered with, because the space inside is expanding while the light is travelling through, so that there is more of the spot by the time the light leaves than it was when it entered, and that changes the wavelength of the light. So that might be the reason that this appears to be a big cold spot in a map of the universe. So unfortunately, no quantum entanglement with another universe yet. As ever, in space stories, more research is needed. And, it is important to say this is a theory which was first brought up in 2007. It has been one possible explanation for this cold spot for a number of years. But it is important. You know, if we hadn't been able to explain this, it may have required everything from a fundamental rethinking of the physics of the Big Bang. And so the fact that this might be something explicable, although really, really weird and really, really big, is an important thing for astronomers. That's all the news this week. Still to come, Wired Health 2015 takes place on Friday, and we're going to discuss the most interesting medical and health technology that we're looking forward to finding out about.
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do, since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
So, team, Wired Health is taking place on Friday.
It is.
What are we looking forward to learning about?
So, yes, I'm really excited to cover a speech which is going to be all about how high-performance elite athletes kind of prepare their bodies for, you know, taking part in those really risky and challenging events.
Just like Michael.
I was going to say.
Yeah.
Except not like Michael.
High-performance elite athletes.
It's actually really good timing, because you're going to get all this advice before you do your marathon. So perhaps there'll be something that you can take away from that.
Terror.
And then apply, realizing that you should have done all of that 3 months ago. But that's what I'm really excited about. How about you guys?
So wearable technology has been a huge story for the last 12, 24, 36 months. But we often just kind of focus on smartwatches or wearable tech, which is flashier, like the Apple Watch, which coincidentally is also being launched on Friday. I think what I'm really interested in finding out about are some of the more specific medical uses for wearable tech. I remember at CES in January, there was a presentation of a wearable thermometer called TempTrack, which is a stickable plaster which can be used for babies, but also for people with hypothalamic dysfunction and other medical issues that mean you can't regulate your temperature, that can feed temperature constantly to a smart device or to a doctor's office. And it's a low-cost but fascinating use of wearable tech. And
so these are smart little objects that have really quite specific uses for people with often quite rare medical conditions.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think because, we often focus on fitness or the idea of counting steps or heart rate and sending data, but not necessarily getting insights. Mm. And we're still at that point where we're collecting more stuff than maybe we can usefully turn into actionable things in our daily lives. But medical wearable tech is getting to the point where it's, you know, really is pushing to the point where it can help people's health in a very specific, practical way. So at Wired Health 2015, we're going to find out about Empatica's Embrace, which is the first medical-grade wearable for people with epilepsy and autism. And that's going to be presented by Matteo Lai. And again, that was a Kickstarter which raised a huge amount of money. Because on the internet, if you're talking about a specific condition, you can find the people with that condition and raise the money necessary to transform what are a relatively low-cost sensors into a package that can improve someone's life.
Mm. I don't know if you know much about this already, but I was just going to ask, is this basically, will the wearer, if they are an epilepsy sufferer, will they kind of get be alerted if their body is showing signs that they might have an epileptic attack?
That's the basic idea. I think there are also discussions about being able to form a connection between a medical professional and the wearer as well, so that you might be able to alert someone else automatically without having to rely on the fact that there's a passerby or someone who can help, or being in a condition that you can do something yourself. So I think it's being able to utilize that data and make a specific action in those kind of vital moments where something very bad might be happening.
And enhance the possibilities for independent living and that kind of thing as well, I guess.
Again, absolutely. And that's wearable tech at its best. It's using data in a smart way and in a focused way that can then solve problems which we haven't had a solution to before. And, you know, we've had pace counters for a long time, and we've had heart rate monitors for a long time. And maybe it's great to have a flashy wearable smartwatch that can do those things, but we haven't really had a solution for people with temperature disorders or epilepsy or other kind of conditions that can be available off the shelf, that are low cost and can work directly with medical professionals.
It feels unlike the majority of kind of consumer wearables out there that these are the wearables that are really proving their use cases. Like, you know, we are still struggling with these wearable devices that present us with a load of data and we're a bit like, that's great, but I don't know what to do about it. Whereas with these ones, it's actually, you know, showing the potential for transforming the way that somebody lives on a day-to-day basis, which I think is great.
That's true. I'm actually currently testing the Microsoft Band as well, which is, to be frank, a very ugly looking smart device.
It's from Microsoft.
I know, it's hard to believe. But what's interesting about it is it has 10 sensors on it, including surface temperature monitors and obviously heart rate. But you know, there's actually a huge amount of tech in there, which theoretically could then plug into some interesting apps and use cases. As a product you would go out and buy, I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. But again, what it proves is that for a relatively low cost, you can get some interesting technology in a very efficient looking device. And there are lots of clever people, including Matteo Lai and others, who have ideas on how to do that. So at Wired Health, we're going to have a special section of these devices, and I'm going to be checking them all out, and we'll have content on that about that on the website all week. So even if you are listening to this after Wired Health has taken place, all that great stuff is going to be on the website, so do check it out. James, what are you looking at in terms of medical health?
Games.
Huh.
As a once avid and still fairly occasional gamer, we've been talking about, and I was writing about this years ago, how video games can make people smarter or can train your brain, intended an awful lot of very good ones for the Nintendo DS, and they proved incredibly popular. But the actual science behind them, despite what the advertising may have claimed, is still a bit hazy. But some people are actually doing proper scientific work to try and understand what video games can do for people's brains. And one of these guys is Adam Gazzelli. He's a cognitive neuroscientist from the University of California. I saw him speak at a conference in Paris back in December last year. He's also going to be at Wired Health. And he's been working on video games that are custom designed to challenge the brain in a very particular way. So, in particular, how can a game stop your brain from aging or improve the brain of an aging person? So one game he developed is called Neuro Racer. So him and his team made this game. It's a really simple racing game, but you have to both drive and avoid obstacles and pay attention to road signs. So you're multitasking. And what they found is by analysing people's EEGs when playing the game, that people that played it on the multitasking mode improved. They got better. So their brain, and this improvement lasted. It didn't just go away when they stopped playing the game. It didn't rewire their brain, but it made an actual difference.
So I suppose if you use the concept that the brain is a kind of muscle that needs exercising, and if you keep it in shape, and if you know, really make sure that you're doing all the different stretches, then then you're more likely to kind of, you know, be nimble for longer.
Absolutely. And the idea is that specific games could target individual neurological problems such as ADD, depression, traumatic brain injury, Alzheimer's disease, and autism. So they're looking at how games can be developed in different ways. And these aren't going to be things like Call of Duty or World of Warcraft. These are going to be quite basic and very intelligently targeted games that will go after the part of the brain that needs massaging, if you like. It's absolutely amazing research. So it landed him a couple of years ago on the front cover of the journal Nature, and from there, interest in it really exploded. And one thing that they showed that I think is absolutely amazing is a closed-loop system. So this uses live feedback from the brain to change the game as you're playing it.
This sounds slightly intense to me.
But you can imagine it wouldn't be for something that you do in your lounge on a Wednesday evening. It would be for serious treatment, therapeutic treatment, and you know, it could make a real, real big difference to some people. So in a demo given last year, he showed two people on a stage, one wearing a wireless EEG cap while playing a rhythm drumming game, and another person wearing an Oculus Rift, and they were connected. The guy wearing the Oculus Rift was flying through the brain of the guy wearing the EEG cap while pretending to drum. It's just incredible. You can see him going through as this guy's brain is sparking up for all the creative thoughts that he's having while drumming to a specific rhythm. It's incredible.
It reminds me actually of a company that I bumped into when I was at the BET Education and Technology Conference, I think last year. And they do a similar thing where they've got a range of games that they use as part of therapy for children with autism, helping them to kind of learn to communicate and to reach out more. And some of the research that they've done around that as well has shown a massive difference, you know, that these technologies can make. And I suppose this is a, you know, what you're probably talking about, Adam's work is probably focused more on kind of adults, but yeah, or older children. But I think for people of all ages, you know, I think it could probably be very simple things like, you know, those games. Or, I mean, I was also wondering, are there ways that they're going to use sort of newer technologies in order to make these games, things like virtual reality and
yeah, so
as
I said, they're using Oculus Rift in this closed loop system. They're going to be looking at motion tracking. I think in one of the laboratories they're using Kinect, the Microsoft technology. So there's all sorts of interesting ways in which just using ordinary everyday consumer technology can be then turned into quite interesting scientific research. And some of the games are running on Android tablets, so they're presented in a way that's really, really accessible, and people are having fun while actually doing some good or helping scientific research.
I think that's the other side, isn't it? Like, if these things to have mass adoption outside of kind of specific treatment, which is part of what you're saying, they need to be fun in the same way that healthy food needs to taste good.
Yeah, so the Racer was developed in collaboration with LucasArts, I think. So they got some help from some proper game developers. And there's another game that they've worked on that's been developed by a proper game development studio. So it's meant to be a game. This is interesting, I think. What really gets me is how dismissive people have been of video games over the years. Oh, it's just a load of fun. What are you doing staring at it? And while kids, sure, maybe play them too much and stare at screens too much, but there is actually a benefit to some games, and they could really, really help people.
Actually, it reminds me, one of my friends, Danny O'Dwyer, he's a games journalist, made a fantastic documentary last year, which will be on YouTube, about how video games have helped various people in different situations through depression. And, you know, I think it was really interesting from my point of view, because you see so much in, you know, in the news about game addiction and the problems that things can cause. And actually, he looked at the totally different side of it, which was there were people who were going through specific things in their life and found that games really helped them through that moment in their lives.
And it will be fascinating to see where all the new development technology that's bubbling under the surface at the moment will take it next.
So the story that I picked out that really excited me to do with health is actually, it's not something that we're going to be talking about at Wired Health 2015, but it is a really big, important breakthrough that's happened this week and that caught my eye. And this is that researchers believe they have found the cause of asthma and also a cheap potential cure.
And this is the cause of asthma.
The cause. So it's one of these things that's been debated for years, because basically there are lots of different symptoms and lots of different kind of things that they know about asthma, but they actually don't, you know, they've been able to work out the triggers, but not necessarily what's happening in the human body. And they've discovered that the culprit appears to be an overactive calcium sensing receptor that up until now was not known to be present in airway tissue. Now, they believe this can be, in fact, they found that this can be deactivated using a commonly available, cost-effective group of drugs called calcilytics. Now, I mean, the majority of people will know somebody who suffers with asthma and will be kind of aware of many of the symptoms, which include inflammation, twitching, narrowing of the airway, and these can be brought on by all sorts of things, triggers such as pollution, pollen, other allergies. And while it's known that some people are more at risk of developing asthma than others, it's not been understood up until now what causes those symptoms. So,
and this is one of those test that, although it was I think a trial carried out on mice, that there was a human element to the trial as well, so this isn't purely speculative. There is a concrete basis for saying that we might be able to treat human asthma in a different way.
Yes, definitely. So they have tried out the drug treatment in mice, but they've also used human airway tissue to confirm the hypothesis. So the next thing that they will have to do is to start human trials, which they believe that they'll be able to do in a year or two. But, you know, they've seen that the drugs can be used to prevent inflammation in basically a model. And they've also tried out, you know, these drugs on people who don't suffer from any asthmatic symptoms, and you know, they found that they don't kind of react at all to them. You know, there's no kind of problems with them. So yeah,
it does seem like this is the kind of thing that should be a bigger issue in an election. This is £10 million. That's not a huge amount of money, and it could affect the lives of 5.5 million people.
Yeah, exactly. There's an enormous number of people in the UK that suffer with symptoms of asthma, and you know, in terms of problems with kind of bronchitis and chronic bronchitis, you know, it's an increasing problem that's causing more and more healthcare problems in the country, and it's going to ultimately kind of result in massive amounts of money being spent on treating people. And for a lot of people with asthma as well, the people that suffer with the most severe symptoms don't tend to respond to the drugs that are available at the moment for treating asthma. So this is like going to be the real breakthrough, because you're going, rather than treating, you know, reacting to the triggers and kind of blocking those off, what you're doing is you're going straight to the sensor, and you're preventing the triggers from even reaching that. And they think that it could be used for preventative measures as well as just reactive to, you know, when somebody is having an asthma attack.
And although, as you said, this isn't something we'll specifically be talking about at Wired Health, it does relate to an interesting piece written by Leah Clark, who isn't in the room today, as we mentioned, on a kind of a similar issue, which is a new genetic test for some types of breast cancer. But the point Leah makes in her opinion piece about it is that specific genetic test only affects a very small number of people who even could get this other type of breast cancer, which is, again, a very relatively small fraction of total breast cancer cases. And the point Leah makes is that spending on medical tests has to be judged in context of all other medical spending, and some breakthroughs affect small numbers of people and aren't necessarily going to, you know, reach the masses. Others have a potential to affect millions, and ultimately at some point it comes down to managing how we invest our money and our time. And if you have a national health service, government priorities and national priorities for which kinds of treatments you focus on. And that's one element, I think, of Wired Health, which is quite interesting, that there are lots of people with great ideas, but ultimately what maybe stops some of those ideas coming to fruition or helps others is that maximum help for the greatest number element.
It reminds me, actually, Bill Gates did a TED talk recently, and we wrote about the kind of the things he was talking about on the site as well, where he was talking about the next epidemic and how we prepare for mass outbreaks, you know, that might not just affect a single country but multiple countries, and could potentially kill, you know, more people than a war. And, you know, looking at how you prepare for medical emergencies on a mass scale like that, I suppose you have to balance it out and think, you know, how are we going to fund these small scale projects that might, you know, still cost an awful lot of money, and also invest in preventing these huge outbreaks that could be devastating. I think as well, this is why healthcare is such an important thing on people's minds as we approach the election. Healthcare spending is, you know, something that people in the UK have very, very strong opinions about, and rightly so.
So time for some of your feedback now. Tony Roberts writes in response to our discussion on the use of Instagram and social media in the elections that you would have thought that Farage would have made great use of Insta filters. Everything UKIP is already saying is seen through a 1950s filter.
Ba-dum-tsh.
Burn.
That's solid, Tony.
Although you're right, filters is something that is underutilised by all the politicians that I examined last week in my Instagram roundup of how our political leaders are performing. So good point, Tony.
Men in suits aren't creative, it turns out.
I know. Can you believe it?
It's outrageous.
Richard Gunther writes, I've been listening to the show since episode one, and while I'm acclimating to what seems like its decidedly more serious tone now, I'm more curious about something. Why the special feature posts? I don't see how these are much different than the occasional features that were previously just incorporated into the main episode. Is there a reason, perhaps publishing timing, that these are now posted as episode-less segments in the feed? This probably all sounds negative, which it's not intended to be. I'm just curious about some of the latest changes. I'm happy to hear you all keeping up with the momentum without missing a beat after Nate's departure.
Oh, thanks, Richard. I mean, in terms of the features that we've been doing, I suppose we've realised that we've got an awful lot of insight and lots of different people on our team who've spoken to really interesting people and who've invested a lot of time in doing these really incredible in-depth features where they've got brilliant access to people. And we thought that one good thing would be to bring those stories to our podcast audience. And this is one of the ways in which we're trying to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I really like those mini episodes. I think if they're not for you or you're not particularly interested in the topic, they mean you can, you know, move on if that's not something you want to listen to. But I the ones that we've done so far, I think, are really, really fascinating. And it's great, I think, for writers of Wired and who primarily write for the magazine to get a chance to be a little bit more present and sit down for a decent amount of time and talk about their story without the pressure of being on the podcast, which has its own, like you said, momentum and structure. So I think they're good, but thanks for the feedback. As to the show's decidedly more serious tone, I don't know if that's just a comment on the way I speak.
Michael is wearing a pink shirt today, so there is nothing serious about his sartorial choices.
Maybe it's just that we are no longer punning as much as we used to. Now Nate has departed. He took his puns with him, I'm afraid. But I don't think everybody thinks that we're being very serious. That we've had feedback that says we're still being, you know, a little bit fun. Isn't that right, Michael?
I hope so, yeah. That comes from Bruce Lee, who writes, "Hi, Wired podcast team. Was just listening to your chat about robots with personalities, and it completely summed up why I love technology in Wired. Silly, light-hearted conversations about great and amazing technology with an undertone of seriousness. Great stuff, keep it up. And the personality my robot would have would be Bruce Lee, for too many reasons to list. Also liked the book recommendations at the end, from Colin."
So not from Bruce Lee.
No, it said Bruce Lee at the top of this. This may be the funny moment of the podcast that we'll have to keep in.
Colin Bruce Lee. Thanks for your feedback.
I have to say, I didn't really react there. Whereas Bruce Lee's written in? That's quite something. That's a lot of effort on his part.
I think that might have been my fault. So sorry about that, Colin. But, you know, there you are. I've renamed you Bruce Lee. As ever, we're grateful to our sponsor Audible for supporting this show. Downloading your free audiobook at audible.co.uk/wired. This week, Why Not Try His Dark Materials by Philip Pullman. Yes, it's fiction rather than fact, but if you're interested in the concept of parallel universes, as we discussed earlier in the show, then it might well be for you.
And as we've mentioned several times, Wired Health is taking place on April 24th. There'll be tons of content on the website, so check that out all week. And we'll see you again next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.